From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Daly City.
Potrero Hill.
Glen Park.
South Beach.
I live in Bernal Heights.
Coming up, we'll find out what a new crop of police trainees will bring to the streets of Oakland.
As long as you are very respectful and how you talk to anybody, it doesn't matter who it is, no matter where they come from, what their background is, they will give you that same respect back.
Then we hear about a program that trains girls of color for futures in STEM.
We're seeing them take the interest that we plant the seed in our classes and take it far beyond what we ever anticipated.
And we'll take a moment to remember Candlestick Park.
No matter how humble the house you grew up in is, you don't want to see it torn down. You'd like to be able to go back home, but you can't go back, I guess.
Remembering the Stick, today on Cross Currents. The Oakland Police Department is getting some good news these days. Crime rates are down in all major categories, including murder, robberies, and burglaries. And the department's getting closer than ever to meeting federally mandated reforms from more than a decade ago. Add to the list the growing ranks of sworn officers. The OPD has had a hard time keeping its numbers above 600 for a couple of years. It's not easy to become a cop in Oakland. OPD receives thousands of applications, but only about 2% are selected for the police academy, and even fewer end up as new officers. The entire process is long and grueling. It takes about a year and a half to go from applicant to trained solo officer. But thanks to dedicated recruitment efforts, there are now more than 100 new cops in Oakland, with nearly 100 more in training. This brings the department to a total of 680 sworn officers, getting closer to the department's goal of 700 by next year. So what does it take to become a cop in Oakland? And who are these new officers working to deter crime? KALW's Kyungjin Lee brings us the story.
We're at the corner of 35th Avenue and Foothill Boulevard in East Oakland. Officer Tim Watermolder just pulled someone over.
The stop is for no front license plate.
So is it just a fix-it ticket? Or?
Yeah, it's just a fix-it ticket.
So they have to be able to do, not only answer the radio, but they have to do proactive work. They have to be able to stop cars, do all that.
That's Don Sawyer. He supervises field training for new cops like Officer Watermolder. Right now, Sawyer's driving around East Oakland to check in on how the new rookies are doing. He says it takes years for individual officers to figure out their unique style of policing. But perfecting the basics at this stage is essential.
Radio is really hard for them. Navigation, driving the car. I don't usually let my trainees drive till about the third week because they have too much going on as it is. And you want them to start to learn to do it all, and you kind of baby steps.
Some rookies weed themselves out throughout the academy and field training. Others don't pass exams required by the state. According to an article in the San Francisco Chronicle, around 20% don't make it to graduation. But the majority get to ride solo, like this officer.
My name is Officer Brenton Lowe. I am 27 years old, and I am from Castro Valley, California.
Lowe's assigned to West Oakland. He's been on the street since 2013. He says he definitely feels more comfortable doing police work now compared to when he started a year ago. But he knows he's still on a steep learning curve.
Even though I have just this tidbit of street policing experience, that's just a small grain of sand along a huge beach.
That's partly because learning how to be a good cop isn't just about being out on the street.
1 second. Your Honor, could we take a quick recess?
Sure.
We're in a courtroom at the Alameda County Courthouse in downtown Oakland. About 50 police trainees sit in the jury box and gallery dressed in full uniform. They're trying a fake robbery case they've been working on since they began the police academy 5 months ago. They're practicing how to respond to detailed questions by the prosecutor, the defense lawyer, and the judge, all played by deputy district attorneys.
After you have gone over your report and you have refreshed your recollection about everything that happened, if it's possible, please visit the scene.
Deputy District Attorney Melissa Dewar explains to the trainees how to prep a case before taking the stand. She says once an officer receives a subpoena from her office, he or she needs to touch base with the prosecutor to make sure they're on the same page.
T. Smith, explain the difference between like civil court and criminal court.
Civil court may only have 6 jurors. You need 12 jurors for a criminal court.
Learning the basics of the courtroom comes after months of intensive training. Before they graduate, the trainees have to show proficiency on 42 different topics, everything from radio codes, or learning how to handle and shoot a gun, or how to give someone CPR or tie a tourniquet. That's after passing an arduous application process that takes 6 to 8 months to complete. And once they graduate, they'll undergo even more training in the field. All in all, it costs the city around $20,000 to hire and train one person.
My name is Nicholas Ramos, and I am 32 years old, and I grew up in El Sobrani, California.
Ramos is still a trainee. He comes from a family of police officers. He spent 10 years working at Best Buy before he joined the force. Ramos says he only applied to the Oakland Police Department, nowhere else, partly because of encouragement from his uncle, who also worked here.
When he heard that I wanted to do law enforcement, he's like, oh man, you got to come here. You got to be a part of the city.
Another big reason is because he wanted to be a part of a younger and more diverse class of officers in Oakland.
And I'm half Mexican and half Japanese. So, you know, I've grown up around a whole bunch of different cultures. And that's greatly represented here in the city.
For me, it was motivating to, you know, become an officer in Oakland and protect the people in the neighborhood that I grew up in.
Courtney Lewis, a North Oakland native, says she's all too familiar with problems in the area.
I've had family members taken from me based upon, you know, gun violence. So for me, it was motivating to, you know, become an officer in Oakland and protect the people in the neighborhood that I grew up in.
She majored in criminal justice in college and says she's always wanted to be a cop. But being in the Oakland Police Academy is doing more than teaching her how to do a job.
It might sound cliche, but to me, it's making me a better person. It's making me a stronger person, both mentally and physically, and it's helped me become more confident in myself.
Her classmate, Nicholas Ramos, says the rigorous training creates a deep bond.
In a very short amount of time, you're put into these very extraordinary situations with people that you've just met. And at the end of the day, like, to the point where I'm at now, I can honestly say that everybody that's in my class I can depend on.
A few weeks later, Oakland Police Chief Sean Wendt conducts firearm and uniform inspections for the 168th graduating class of the Oakland Police Academy. Trainees Ramos and Lewis, along with 45 of their peers, get their badges, then swear in as new officers.
I state your name.
I.
Solemnly swear.
They all have their new assignments. Some will start on patrol, others on crime reduction teams. But over the next 4 months, they'll rotate duties to get a taste of every aspect of police work.
This is Sergeant Hubbard.
This is my
Sergeant
father.
Great job, you guys did.
After the ceremony, new officer Nicholas Ramos introduces his trainer to his dad, who's a retired cop himself. Ramos has been assigned to West Oakland. He says there's one quality he'll bring to that community.
A long time ago, I learned that as long as you are very respectful in how you talk to anybody, doesn't matter who it is, no matter where they come from, what their background is, if you show them respect, they will give you that same respect back.
New officer Courtney Lewis gets to return to her home turf of North Oakland. She says her lifelong connection to the neighborhood will help her relate to community members, and it'll be easier on her nerves.
I mean, you're going to be nervous regardless, whatever kind of job, no matter how many skills they teach you, you have to just get out there and do it.
More academies are in the works for this year, and the number of new officers continues to grow. For Lewis and her classmates, the real test will be in the streets of Oakland. For Cross Currents, I'm Kyungjin Lee.
If you're a police officer in training, what's on your mind as you train? And if you live in Oakland, what do you think makes a good cop? Tell us on our feedback line. It's 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. Thank you. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. In Oakland, men and women can train to be police officers, and young girls of color can train to be tech workers. Electrical engineer and computer programmer Kimberly Bryant says when she was in college, she was only one of a few women and the only black woman in her class. When she had her own daughter, Kai, she thought, how do we get more young girls of color into science, technology, engineering, and math, STEM fields, to be part of the growing tech industry? The answer came in April 2011 when she launched a company and called it Black Girls Code, teaching girls how to build their own websites, make computer games, and most importantly, she says, train girls for futures in STEM. Bryant and her daughter Kai joined me in studio, and I asked Bryant about the challenges of being a woman of color in tech.
I think some of the same challenges that I face as a woman, I face as a woman of color. And I think the race piece adds an extra bit of a complexity to my journey as an engineer in the field of technology. So isolation and being in this field that's dominated by white males can be intimidating to people of color that are going into the field of technology for the first time. I think the lack of exposure in our communities and underrepresented communities to this field, there's not going to be a lot of computer scientists in the inner city neighborhood as your next door neighbor. For the most part, you just don't see our kids that are coming through these underrepresented neighborhoods and inner cities and in areas where they don't have access to lots of Stanford's not next door, or there's no one that really is in the field of technology. That lack of exposure plays a part because they don't even know that it's a thing. So most of the kids that are coming through our programs, they don't know what computer science is when they come into our first class. They don't know what it is to build a website and how they get an app on their phones that they're using on a day-to-day basis. So not knowing is half of the problem that we see with our kids.
So you were inspired by your daughter.
Yes.
Your daughter is here with us.
She is.
Hi, Kai.
Hi.
So, are you part of this because your mother is an engineer? Is it in your blood? Tell me about what subjects you liked in school and what do you like?
Well, from early age, I had an affinity, I guess you could call it, for technology and video games. I just played them all day, and my mom obviously wasn't too happy about that because she didn't like me being such a consumer of other people's things and of their products. She wanted to see me being my own entrepreneur and making my own games.
And so is that primarily one of the ways that you bring the girls in? And is it expected that they then stay in this industry, or can they then, like, do you give them the tools to branch out into other fields within tech?
Yes. So we try to introduce the girls to all different phases of technology. So we do web design, we do mobile app development, we do game design. We're just starting to get into robotics and more of the electronic side of technology. But we really try to introduce them to as many facets of the industry as possible, because we're not really sure what's going to tap into what girls' interests, and we want to make sure they know everything there is that's available to them. We really try to build these classes around their interests. So they're into web, they like to spend time on the web, they like mobile, they like fashion, they like art, they like gaming. And so really building our workshops around those things that they already like is kind of the hook that gets them excited. So we're saying, oh, well, you know how you play this game? Now you can create one. And that really gets them, like, all in, where they really take it far beyond what we teach in classes. So I have girls that are in our program that we taught them, say, an introductory course in Scratch, that are now learning to do more complex game design on Unity, which is another professional platform that gamers use. I have girls that are building mobile app sites at their home and putting in them the Google Play Store, putting in them the iTunes Store. I have girls that are doing robotics, and we just do a little robotics at Black Girls Code, but they've done things on their own. So we're seeing them take the interest that we plant the seed in our classes and take it far beyond what we ever anticipated.
Do you think, coding means literacy?
today. And if you don't code, then you are, you know, you are behind, you will be behind, you will be left behind.
I often hesitate to say that everyone should learn to code, and it is the same as what we would consider basic reading literacy. But it is an important literacy for our youth of today because technology touches everything. So no matter if they want to go into the arts, if they want to go into medicine, if they go into a more scientific career, in each of those, they will be utilizing technology in some form or fashion in the course of their work. So it's critically important that they at least understand the language and understand how to communicate in that language to the folks that are working around them to do their jobs and to get their jobs and their goals done in their careers. So it is a critical literacy that our kids must learn, but not the only one. It doesn't replace the basic reading, writing, and arithmetic in my book, but it is a necessary addition to the skill sets that we need to empower our youth with.
So I'm not a girl anymore. I'm a woman, Kai, and I don't know how to code. Is it easy to learn?
It depends on what you start with. I mean, obviously, you can't go like straight into some hardcore Python, probably, unless you go
Python.
Really, really slow or something like that. But you just have to just maybe, if you want to learn it on your own, just look up some tutorials, and they should be pretty straightforward. And many misconceptions that my friends have and many people I know have is that coding's too hard, I can't do it, it's only for smart people.
Mm.
But that's not the truth, because you are smart, they are smart, and you can do it just like anyone else can. You are just as good as them. They went through the same struggles, and they started at the beginning just like you are if you're going to learn how to code.
That's Kai and her mother, Kimberly Bryant, founder of Black Girls Code. This Saturday, they're having a Build a Game in a Day workshop for girls age 7 to 17 in Oakland. Details are at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. A number of you called about some stories we've aired recently. Let's start with our report on a new dog management plan for the Golden Gate National Recreation Area. The proposed plan is an effort to regulate the rising number of dogs and visitors to the parks and could put an end to walking dogs off leash. Here's what some of you had to say about that.
Hi, this is Joel Perlstein calling. Personally, I'm looking forward to the ban on dogs on areas on the beach, because now when I go to the beach to look at shorebirds as a birder, I don't get to see them because the dogs are busy chasing them. Okay, thanks. Bye.
Hi there. My name is Wild Bill Peacock. If off-leash recreation is taken away, it will basically ruin living in San Francisco for a lot of people. It will all go to city parks. Dogs will have less exercise and less space. The dog's behavior will deteriorate. This is a line in the sand. We're going to fight. I can't imagine trying to walk six dogs on leash at Fort Funston. That is absolutely absurd. Thank you. Bye.
A listener named Shessa called in to comment about our story on limited late transit across the bay.
I want to suggest that a good late night transportation would be a ferry, because tourists would take it too. And that would make sure that there were plenty of people wanting to do it. And it'd certainly be a romantic venue. Thank you.
We always love to hear your feedback and your ideas. Leave us a message at 415-264-7106, and we might put your comment on the air. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. This Thursday night, Paul McCartney will close the show at San Francisco's Candlestick Park. It'll be the final public event at the storied stadium. So this week, we're looking back at the defining memories that lit the stick. Today, we'll hear from KALW morning announcer Joe Burke, a born and raised San Franciscan and diehard 49ers and Giants fan. He reflects on attending Giants games as a child.
The first one I remember was in the third grade, which would make me eight, I guess. I was in school, and the school classroom door had that window on it, and if you saw the principal coming towards your classroom, you knew there was trouble. And I saw one day the principal coming straight for our classroom, and right behind her was my dad, and I knew I was in trouble. I just knew it. And she came in, and Mr. Burke and Mrs. Freeman, Mr. Burke, principal wants to see you outside. And I went outside, and she said, come with us. And we went walking to the office, and before we could get to the office, where I thought I was going to really get a good screaming at for something, my dad grabbed me and said, okay, thank you. And we walked out the front door, and I was just, I had no idea whether I'd been expelled or what. He goes, no, we're going to the Giants game. And he had tickets in what was, at Candlestick, used to be called the mezzanine level. Now they'd call it like the luxury boxes at AT&T Park. But it was, somehow, I don't know how he did it, because I never saw these tickets again. He swung tickets in the mezzanine. It was Juan Marichal pitching against Bob Gibson. I remember it was the St. Louis Cardinals. And that's the first game I really remember. But mostly, I think, because I thought I was in big trouble until we got outside of school that day. When we were really little, our folks would take us, like for a birthday or something, you know, my brother and I and my mom and dad, and take a friend or two. And when we got a little older, my brother and I would spend the summers out there. You'd get on the bus at 25th and Geary for 15 cents and ride it all the way out to Candlestick. And it was, we spent a lot of time out there, me and my brother and our friends. And at that time, you're really not watching the ball game unless Willie Mays is hitting. You're kind of running around and having hot dog fights and, you know, throwing stuff at each other. Not necessarily just watch baseball, though you did that too. There's nothing like walking into the ballpark as you come out of the stands, and the doors, so to speak, open up, and there's the field in front of you. It's a very special experience, and Candlestick was that for many, many years. As miserably cold as it was, and as many times as it cost us games or chances at playoffs and that sort of thing, it still was home, and, you know, that's kind of how it is. No matter how humble the house you grew up in is, you don't want to see it torn down. You'd like to be able to go back home, but you can't go back, I guess.
That was KALW's Joe Burke sharing his memories of Candlestick Park. His story was produced by Ted Muldoon. We want to hear your memories, too. Share your Candlestick story at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. And that does it for today's edition of Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Lila Day, Sandhya Dirks, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Suki Lewis, Holly J. McDeed, Ted Muldoon, and Rachel Vasquez. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Our line producer was Audrey Dilling. Our senior producers are Julie Kane and Jen Sheehan. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. And thank you. We're listener-supported public radio. This is the Oakland band Mr. Kind. You can hear more from Mr. Kind at Bottom of the Hill in San Francisco this Friday night. Show starts at 9 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.
The result of many months boiling over all at once. shift. Things once thought as frustrating can be missed.